You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 54. It depends on where the balance of power happens to be in this period of time, and 5G might just shift the balance of power back to the servers.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone, to The Local Maximum. February 18th, 2019. Welcome to The Local Maximum. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode where I got my behavioral assessment done. And as promised, this week we are going to hear the rest of the conversation I had with Aaron from 2 weeks ago. This is about the upcoming 5G standard and takeaways from the recent Consumer Electronics Show. A couple of reasons why we're going over this. What do you get out of this as a listener? Yes, some of this is a little bit out of our area of expertise, but one thing that we're trying to do here on The Local Maximum is to give you some way of forecasting technology and imagining the products of our future and how to navigate that. And that's why we really need to dig into this. So what does it really mean when we get more bandwidth? And what are these companies that are selling AI? You know, the ones that have a real product in mind, the ones that aren't just fluffing themselves up. They say they want to build, you know, digital assistants, what can they really accomplish? And is there a connection between the two or not? So join me today in this discussion. This is an open discussion. I want, I want some feedback on this. I invite you. And by the way, please correct me if I need to be corrected on some of the specifics. So for example, I learned after I recorded that text messaging, the SMS protocol, that came out in the 2G standard, not the 3G standard. So maybe I can get dinged on that. It's hard to keep track of all the 2G, 3G, 4G, hard to keep track of all this. These come out like once every 10 years. So for those of you who know more about these wireless standards than I do, I welcome your impact to correct the record, localmaxradio@gmail.com. So again, I ask, what does all of this mean, if anything, for virtual reality, for self-driving cars, for security, and for augmented reality? And by the way, augmented reality is really being, I don't want to say that it's at the top of the hype cycle, but I think we're in the portion of the cycle of hype, where the product thinkers are really coming out with their grand visions. If you Google around on this, you'll see. There's this idea being popularized in the last few weeks. They're calling it the mirror world. Think of a huge representation of the whole planet, sort of like a souped up Google Earth that you can kind of walk around in and explore. And then you could add some extra things, extra game elements that don't exist. Like, maybe dinosaurs. I think we could use a T-Rex walking through Madison Square Park or something like that. See what that would look like. I don't know what this is useful for, but people want to build it. So I'll just post all the links on that on localmaxradio.com/54, which you should check out. Without anything further, let's bring up the discussion.
Yeah, so this, we originally started looking into this in the wake of CES, which I guess is now a few weeks old, but it was really kind of a preview of what is 2019 gonna have in store for us. So given that we're about 8% into 2019, I think this is all still pretty relevant.
Right. Oh yeah, absolutely. And the idea of 5G network, that is going to be big news. Well, we don't know how big the news is going to be yet, and that's the open question.
Well, the news is big, but it will be news. But yeah, what's the impact going to really be?
Right. And we'll talk about that. But that is going to be on people's minds for the next several years. And so it's important to start talking about that so we understand what 5G is and what how to think about it in terms of the next wave of consumer products. Is it as big as 4G, which was pretty big, or is it not? So I'm looking at, in particular, this New Year's Eve article in the New York Times called 5G, What You Need to Know. And so for those of you who remember, these generations of cellular networks, they come out once every 10 years. And the reason why there's such a long kind of lag time in this is that each generation requires new infrastructure. It uses different radio band frequencies, which I don't understand that much. I understand a little bit about it. So it really requires building out a whole new network.
Yeah, well, it's kind of multifaceted because there needs to be kind of industry agreement on how we're going to define this.
So I want to get it out there. It's not like Verizon comes out and say, hey, guess what, everyone? We just invented 5G. Here it is. Give it a try. No, that's not what happens. They all get together and they say, this is a standard. This is how the radio bands are going to be used. This is how the messages are going to get encoded and decoded. And these are going to be the capabilities that we're going to allow. And then the companies can build the network through those specifications
and not only do the,
and they work with each other.
Not only do the big industry players have to come to an agreement on that, but because bandwidth, the airwaves are a collective resource, they need to get, you know, FCC approval and buy-in for how they're doing that as well. And possibly the allocation of that bandwidth, which I guess the allocation of the bandwidth kind of preceded that. I think there were a couple of years back, there was an auction of big sections of bandwidth. I don't know if that's directly tied into the development of 5G, but it wouldn't surprise me that how that was freed up and then purchased by different carriers heavily influenced how they decided to define this next generation that will take advantage of that.
Yeah. So each generation kind of brings brand new capabilities. I believe it was, I'm not sure which one, I think it was it 3G that brought texting? I think it was 3G. That's a good example.
That rolled out SMS?
Yes.
Or was there texting before SMS? I don't even know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I do know, though, that the original iPhone, even though 3G was available at the time, was 2G. And there were a lot of kind of smartphones at the time, the Razr, et cetera, that were coming out in the mid-2000s.
The Razr that's coming back?
Yeah, the Razr that's coming back, that were essentially, I mean, the Razr's not that old. I don't know. It's 10 years old. They marketed those as being internet-capable phones. But if you ever used one at the time, you realize, like, technically, yes, it's internet-capable, but is it practical? No, it's not practical. So, because it's just way too slow. So the 3G ones were the first ones that were really practical. And the 4G ones were the ones where you really had all of these applications come to life. Even Foursquare, and I know Foursquare existed before 4G, but really before 4G, it was really such a pain in the neck to do a lot of things. There's a lot of waiting, and particularly something with Foursquare, yeah, well, and the information now, it's a big deal. And especially if we wanted, you know, in 2011, when people were starting to get 4G phones, like we wanted to add pictures and photos, and Twitter was adding photos, and they were adding videos, and videos especially, you really need 4G for that sort of a thing. And so that's 4G was coming out, I guess, somewhere around the turn of the decade, I don't know, 2010. And so then you saw the app craze, I guess, where all of these apps are jumping on the bandwagon and building a lot of features that previously could not have been built.
Yeah, well, and I remember the era when not only was text messaging, SMS messaging still fairly new, but you know, you either had a plan that included X number of text messages or you paid by the message. Which is kind of unheard of now, that pretty much every plan comes with unlimited SMS of some sort.
Right.
Because that's so minuscule compared to the amount of data that we use for everything else.
Yeah. So the question is now, you know, what is it? Okay, what capabilities will 5G allow that will change the game with our phones? Or will it just be just a little faster? Doesn't seem like that big of a deal. And also, like, I'm remembering, and just this is just kind of a devil's advocate, like regular person on the street issue that to consider, or maybe I'm complaining about what just happened to me. I brought my iPad down, and this is really with both wireless and the 4G network that I'm on. It didn't matter. I brought my iPad down to the gym. Okay, I wanted to watch a video on it. I wanted to stream something on Netflix while I was on the elliptical, right? And so it turned out that the Netflix app was in the cloud. Okay?
Okay.
No big deal. I should be able to download my Netflix app, right? And so I clicked to download my Netflix app. And whether it was the Wi-Fi in the gym, which is pretty fast, it might be considered, it might be similar to what 5G might be, or whether I was using my 4G cellular network, it wouldn't download because while I was sleeping, the iPad thought it would be a good idea to download my entire Apple photo library, and it was out of space. And so a lot of the frustrations that we deal with on a day-to-day basis are not about network speeds. We're dealing with server speeds from the companies that we're dealing with. We're dealing with, you know, software glitches or abnormalities. And so there's a lot of things I think this will not fix. You know, it will not be, the science fiction always shows like the technology just works immediately. I would like to see a science fiction where there's really cool, unbelievable technology, but there are like these little glitches that happen along the way because, you know, just technology does that.
Yeah, but one of the use cases they keep throwing out in descriptions of the advantages of 5G is that, oh, you'll be able to download a feature-length film in seconds instead of, you know, 10 minutes. Unless the use case is, oh, I have connectivity now and I'm about to go into the subway and I won't, and I need to get this, or, you know, I'm about to go on an airplane where I won't have connectivity and so I need to download it all right now.
And you do have it on the airplane now.
Yeah, but the actual use case is, well, if I can download it fast enough so that I just stay ahead of where I am and can stream it, then that's perfectly suitable.
Yeah, so I am pretty sure that that will not be the killer app, but it will be something that will be, you know, given as an example. And it is quite amazing to think, okay,
yeah, I think it's more of a benchmark of measuring how much the speed increases than a realistic use case for justifying it.
Yeah, yeah. And another thing they're saying is several order of magnitudes reduced latency. And again, I don't know exactly what the, you know, it's hard to get a sense of what frustrations are caused by network latency and what are caused by other issues. And
well,
so,
yeah, I mean, network latency is a big deal for anything where the actual work is being done in the cloud. And so it's not a question of the size of the pipe, but how much time it's taking to talk back and forth. Or some of the more advanced use cases they're talking about that go beyond what we currently use our cellular network for.
That's what I wanted to get into. Because first of all, there is the possibility that this could be kind of a dud. I don't want to like say, you know, everything I talk about, I kind of like say, look at the possibilities here. But sometimes technology comes out and it turns out, yeah, 2G was a huge deal. 3G was a huge deal. 4G was a huge deal. 5G, maybe not as big of a deal.
Well, and it wouldn't be unprecedented because, what was it? WiMAX was supposed to change the way that internet was brought to less developed parts of America. And I don't think that ever really got off the ground other than some basic test cases. That it wouldn't be the first time something in this wireless communication spectrum was overhyped and underdelivered.
Yeah, sure. So I think that one of the applications that people are talking about, and this is something that I've spoken about, I mentioned it with Dennis on episode 7, or he mentioned it, was augmented reality, which people are really interested in. A lot of product people are really interested in, and gaming people are really interested in the idea of augmented reality. You see it a lot in, you know, Apple demos. And actually, there are a lot of people who are interested in augmented reality, you know, outside of gaming as well, for like, real industrial purposes. But we have the processing power on the phone for that. But the idea is, if you want to do the processing power in the cloud for augmented reality, the idea is maybe you can build new and fantastical things into the existing world through the phone that I don't know what people would build, but creative people maybe will build some very interesting use cases on that. Unfortunately, I don't have the, you know, my creative thinking on that is limited at this time. I'm trying to rack my brain.
Yeah. Not directly tied to augmented reality, but you mentioned industrial applications, and one of the places that latency comes in as a big deal is in that industrial use case, and that's where the buzzword I think is edge computing has become very important. That you don't necessarily want to have all your heavy computing resources out on your manufacturing floor. That's not a viable solution, and having it all up in the cloud, the latency is too long. That you have safety concerns that because something goes wrong on the manufacturing floor with robots, and there's a latency delay, and that could cause significant damage or even risk to life. So they've come up with these solutions where instead of being in the cloud, they're on the edge, where they have basically their own cloud there and a solution in place that provides extremely low latency but allows them to offload a lot of that processing to the local cloud.
And so if you can
provide this on a much wider spread basis as opposed to, you know, in a single industrial factory floor, but to, you know, a city to have that same low latency capability, then there's significant opportunities for leveraging that.
So what do you think? Let's try to be more specific. Like what? Like give maybe a story of what you see someone using this for, like as an example, like a specific industry, a specific problem.
That's a tricky one, but I mean, I guess the use case in the factories is pretty much always involves some sort of robotics or some semi-autonomous system like that. And if you can spread the net where this low latency network is effective beyond, you know, a single tightly controlled facility, then what's to prevent the Amazon style warehouse robots from operating outside of the warehouses and, you know, basically replacing your UPS man. If you've got a system where they can travel through the city now as little autonomous package deliverers, it's not nearly as sexy as the Amazon drones. Although if this system is as reliable and low latency as they say it is, then that could very well be part of what they use to control the drones as well.
Do you think this is really something that you need 5G for?
Do you need it? No, but having a low latency, high bandwidth solution that ties into that is very attractive because
I could see that.
Especially so in the drone case.
Especially when you need to get in touch with these things, you need to have a control panel. Like there's got to be someone sitting there in central command. Not central command, there'll be different ones, but like I could imagine someone watching, you know, five deliveries unfold at once. Or you could even have it automated. And so sometimes you have to reroute things very quickly.
Well, part of the problem
is that
with,
what it is? But I feel like rerouting something is not, yeah, sorry.
Is that they need to have all of the, so either they're being flown, you know, by a pilot line of sight. Or they have some level of autonomous capability.
We're talking about the drone now.
Yeah. So you know, if they lose connection to their home base, then they have some pre-programmed behavior or some series of behaviors that'll allow them to safely, you know, bring themselves down or continue on to their destination. But if you have a system in place that's highly reliable with low latency and high bandwidth, you don't need all of that hardware and that intelligence on board. You can move that back into your server farm at the home base, and now you've either reduced the size, weight, and power consumption of your drone, or you've exchanged that for additional cargo capacity or additional endurance or distance capability.
Yeah, I see. So it allows you to offload computation into the server. So I could think,
yeah, and there's been mention of doing this in autonomous cars as well.
Yeah. Oh, we'll get to that in a second. I can tell you what I'm imagining. Let's say I am in an empty theater, an empty sound stage, and someone's going to be performing there soon. And I can hold up my phone or my iPad or whatever and say, okay, put the speakers over there. Put a giant prop over there. Put the sound equipment over there, and put the people over there, and then have them start doing their act. So it's like some kind of a augmented reality concert type situation, and maybe I'm using it because I'm actually trying to set up the concert. I'm trying to do the logistics and the choreography and whatnot to make sure it all works and it all looks good. That could be an example of I know it's industrial application, but it's like it's a business application. Again, could the phones just do that, or is there a benefit to having this virtual world in the cloud with the computation, in servers? Is that I'm not entirely sure.
Well, and I don't know if we've talked about this on the show before, but I there's a lot of discussion in the video game world about the next generation of consoles there and what route they're going to take. And my speculation is that there's going to be a greater push to have less hardware in the console at the consumer side, that it's going to be more of kind of a server terminal paradigm that you saw a couple generations ago in the computing world.
Yeah, it's amazing how that comes back and forth. There seems to be cycles where the smarts go into your personal computer, the computing power essentially, and then it's like, no, it's better to put the computing power back into the server. And it seems like it depends on where the balance of power happens to be in this period of time, and 5G might just shift the balance of power back to the servers.
Yeah, well, because if latency and processing power are a concern, then there are definite benefits to doing everything locally. But if you can get down to sufficiently low latency that it's undetectable to humans, or at least undetectable to humans of the sensitivity that your consumer class is at. So maybe your world class StarCraft players will still be using custom gaming rigs, because those couple of microseconds of additional latency make a difference there. But for most users, it's not going to be effective. So you have cheaper, less complex hardware on the user side, and you're running everything through the pipe on your server farm, and then all of a sudden, you can have your next generation console. It doesn't actually require changing the consumer side hardware. You're just changing what's running on the Amazon Web Services server farm, and maybe swapping out some of your GPUs in your own facility. And so you can roll that out to the consumer, and you move to a gaming platform as a subscription service, instead of every 5 to 10 years you buy the next generation of physical console.
Right, I could see that, and the world that everyone interacts with is on a central server. You and I remember playing Rise of Nations, where I think that the very simple world that in these old games is, I think, on one of the participants' computers, and then everybody has to kind of download that in real time, and it's a mess.
Yeah, somebody is playing host.
There's always a bug with like the merging of the information, because there isn't like one central place of where it really complicates things. So, other areas where low latency really matters, I could think of. One is high frequency trading, which I don't think I want to get into here. the second one, as you mentioned, are self-driving cars, which you talked about in episode 43. Connected cars. Connected cars is different from self-driving cars. You could have a connected car without it being self-driving. I feel like there are a lot of safety features that could come from cars being connected. And let's say every Tesla car can talk to nearby Tesla cars. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, I guess so. And I mean, kind of the brass ring for connected cars is the when you combine that with autonomous vehicles is the kind of self-assembling train model, where cars are now traveling in the far left lane at, you know, 200 miles an hour, bumper to bumper, because the autonomous, you know, the self-driving algorithm can do that while talking
to
the other cars.
And Aaron, imagine getting into a car and then it takes you bumper to bumper 200 miles an hour.
But there are no human drivers in that lane. And so,
yeah, it's like, calm down, go to sleep. You will
be fine. We're not there yet, but that's kind of, that's the model that people are talking about eventually getting to for maximum efficiency gains there.
Yeah. But in the short term.
And obviously you want to have really, really tight control loops between the vehicles there so that you don't have somebody, you know, making a course correction slightly out of time with the rest of the caravan and causing a, you know, 15 car pileup or something.
Do you feel like though, something more of a mesh network might work better for that? Where the cars are talking directly to each other.
Well, so I am shocked that hasn't been deployed already.
Because there are, and
maybe it's not as widespread as it once was, but there's definitely a period where cars were coming out with their own built-in wireless access points, essentially.
Sure. I mean, we have them on the buses. You know, I took a bus to DC a couple weeks ago.
If you get a critical mass of those out there, instead of me having a cell subscription, essentially, that runs to my car or a satellite connection to my car that then broadcasts to the people inside of it a wireless network, a Wi-Fi network. Why not have all the cars making an ad hoc mesh network where they connect to each other?
I should slow down and realize that we have we have a broad audience here. So a mesh network is... just imagine like each car is talking to all the nearby cars, and you don't have the cellular network is not even included. It's just direct peer to peer.
Well, it's much like how the internet is structured,
right?
In a larger sense, that there's not like a single path to get somewhere. There are multiple ways you can get there, and if one drops out, then it reroutes around those, and it's dynamically changing as necessary.
Yeah. So I think we've speculated on how a bunch of these things can work, but I suspect that there are a lot of listeners out there that know a whole lot more about this.
Oh, for sure. And
so if you are one of those listeners, please send me your information at localmaxradio@gmail.com, because I have a feeling there's some stuff that we either skipped or maybe one of our suggestions, I wouldn't be surprised if one of the suggestions that I mentioned maybe doesn't work, or maybe already works without 5G.
Yeah, we may have talked beyond our expertise quite a bit already.
A little bit. But I'm just basing it on the article that I'm reading and some of the stuff that I've already known. This comes out somewhere. It's a phased rollout. It should start sometime this year, Q2 2019. I think we'll start seeing it in our mobile phones. I bet it won't be in the iPhone this year, but
right, yeah. So they've said Apple is not going to come out with a 5G phone until 2020, which begs the question: is Apple missing out on something? Are they making a tactical mistake, or have they judged the situation accurately and said there's no point in us coming out with a consumer product that has support for this until the infrastructure is in place to actually deliver it?
Yeah, until they have an idea of what they're selling. Like,
what
is it that we can do with it? That they need to have some research time to say, what is it that we can do with it that we can sell? Because 5G will be a big selling point when they come out with the first 5G iPhone. Or they're going to try to make it a selling point. I don't know if it'll be that interesting to people at that time. I really think that people are sick of hearing about the iPhone. But if they can say, oh, you can do these five things with it, and the demos are incredible, then people will rush to buy that iPhone. I don't know if Apple is the type of company that can deliver on this anymore, but I certainly want to see them have a go at it. But I'm okay with waiting a couple of years.
Yeah, and you mentioned at the beginning that part of the reason that this is such a big rollout and that it happens, you know, every 10 years or so is that there's extensive infrastructure building that needs to happen. They need to put up towers. And that's started in some markets. I want to say Houston is one of the initial rollouts, but the majority of the country does not have 5G coverage yet. And it's going to take a while before it gets there with major investment by Verizon, Sprint, and AT&T.
I go back to that self-driving car episode when I said that there's like this misleading graph that says technology is upgrades like quicker and quicker and quicker. But no, there are still some really long-term projects that happen. And these cellular networks are one of them. Rebuilding that entire infrastructure takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of time. And every time you do it, there are brand new problems to solve.
Yeah, well, and there's some interesting caveats there. That so we mentioned that frequencies come into play here. What everyone's talking about is the millimeter wave frequencies that are part of 5G. It allows much higher bandwidth, but also there's a trade-off there because in the world of electricity and magnetism, there is no free lunch. So you get much higher bandwidth, but a given tower with a given amount of power has a much shorter range. So in order to cover the same areas, they need to put up more towers. This is also combined with...
Is that the only solution? Yeah, sorry. What do they combine it with?
There may be some other ways around that, but there are also... 5G is not just the millimeter wave frequencies. There's also some lower frequencies in play, which leads to the issue that not all 5G devices will be compatible with all 5G networks. So you may have, perhaps Verizon will only make use of the millimeter wave portion. And so they're going to probably make sure that any products they're selling as Verizon 5G phones are aligned with that portion of the network. But if you're in an area that is dependent on AT&T's 5G network, they may have a combination of the high frequency and low frequency, or they may just have some of the low frequency 5G components. And your phone is not guaranteed by virtue of being quote unquote 5G to play nicely with all aspects of 5G. Yeah. So you could very well have a 5G phone and be in a city that has a 5G network, but they don't dovetail to each other.
Do you remember back when there was the dichotomy between, what was it, CDMA and what was the other one? I don't remember.
Is it GSM?
Yeah, I remember like I had one and then it wouldn't, like half of them worked in half the countries, and when you're traveling.
Well, so it's still a thing. I want to say that there's a difference between like the Sprint and the AT&T network that there's a fundamental difference in the technologies they use for switching, I believe, that is not necessarily compatible. And that's part of why when you buy a phone, it's not just locked to a network because they're being jerks about it. It's that there's a version of the phone that has the right antennas and the right chips to play on one company's set of antennas and another that can play on the other. And
yeah.
And there are some that can do both, but it's not necessarily the water doesn't flow equally in both directions in that equation.
Right. Okay. So what's the upgrade? There's one more thing I want to mention, and then if there's nothing you want to mention, we should go on to some of the CES stuff. But then there's the question of, can this replace fiber for homes and offices? In other words, if you're near particularly one of the higher frequency areas where you can get this high speed 5G connection, do you need Fios at home? And so if the answer is no, that's really interesting. I remember when I moved into a new apartment, Verizon took like 3 weeks to set up internet. It was really, really frustrating. If I could do everything I needed to do on the cellular network, I might not bother with it.
Yeah, I mean that's the one advantage.
And
I
how big
there.
Of a deal is that? It could be a big deal in terms of the business model of these companies like Verizon and such. Because
yeah, on the one side, I'm hesitant to get excited about that because who provides cable in some markets? Well, it's Verizon, who is, you know,
which they forced me to get
also
all
a cellular company, and in some places it's you know, Dish Network is your satellite. But guess what? Dish and AT&T are in bed with each other. So is it really going to change that much who you're buying that service from, because it's really the same companies behind it? Probably they will get their pound of flesh no matter how you go about getting your internet connection. But if it makes the setup process and the integration less painful, then I might be willing to take that in exchange for perpetuating their monopolies.
Yeah, it is right. If you want to be overly optimistic about it, it could make cord cutting a little bit easier, you know, just getting rid of, I'm almost at the point where I just get rid of cable, you know, get HBO, get something that allows me to get movies, because I have, like, you know, Netflix, Amazon, whatever, forget all of it. I mean, a lot of people do it, but maybe this could accelerate that process. But like you said, these companies are going to think of something to fight back against that. Although there is an outside chance that they could kind of embrace something that's a lot more streamlined.
Yeah, well, and there's a potential argument to be made, and it really depends on the business case for, you know, there's no way we could make the finances work to lay, fiber optic cable to this less densely populated, further from an urban center area. But we can throw up some 5G towers and get them an equivalent service at much less infrastructure cost, and now they're being better served. I don't know if the money works out right to justify that case, but that's one possible direction that this could go.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I think we're going to wrap that up. Unless you have something to add, I think we want to just go.
I think
back
we've,
to the CS.
We've said more about 5G than I was. Well, let me throw out one tidbit. I have a,
except for one thing.
Yeah. I have a friend who works in that kind of, electromagnetic, communication spectrum world. Well, he's not working directly on 5G. He's working on some stuff that kind of interfaces with that. I was chatting with him last weekend, and I looked down at his old iPhone. It may have even been a 4, but I think it was an iPhone 5 something. And I saw it said 5G on it. I was like, oh wow, you got a 5G sticker on that. How's that work? He says, yeah, I put the sticker on, and now it's 5G. And it's just like what some of the cell phone retailers are doing, that they're labeling these. It doesn't do anything, but it looks really cool.
need a 6G sticker. Yeah,
buyer beware that with the infrastructure not yet being fully in place, and with some sellers maybe touting 5G capability that really hasn't materialized yet.
Yeah. Okay, so CES in 2019. This is the one where you were kind of on assignment. I wish I could send you to CES, but budget was a little tight this year. So we're looking at again at the New York Times, 2019, January 3rd, Tech 2019 overhyped.htm is the link. So
yeah,
you can tell what they think. They put their opinion in the headlines. No, actually, that's not. The headline is devices that will invade your life in 2019 and what's overhyped. But the URL is just Tech 2019 overhyped. So we know what they're really thinking.
Yeah, and they start off by talking about how AI was the top trend in 2018, and it is again in 2019. So clearly that means that we're not in a period of rapid innovation, but
say something
but
that
iteration.
Annoys me with this, because AI can mean so many things these days.
Well, yeah.
And let's start, look. I mean, it could mean the big data. They're spying on you. They know your every move. They're coming to get you. That's AI. It could be. You know, I hear, and I'm just from listening, you know, listening to a lot of radio and listening to a lot of podcasts, oh, someone is going to invent general AI, and it's going to get out of control, and it's going to take over the world. And
yeah, thanks,
I don't
Sky
buy
Matt.
Any of that. I don't buy any of that crap. But I was listening to someone this morning who was talking about that. And
Can you train your well, I guess you can't. You can't change AI, the trigger word for your Amazon assistant device beyond the preset values.
Well, I don't know. But
I'd really like to have mine respond to Skynet.
Skynet, yeah. So AI can also mean just these sort of chatbot type situations where we anthropomorphize our current set of technologies, which, you know, does use a lot of kind of AI. There are machine learning and natural language processing algorithms under the hood, but that's just sort of the consumer AI that we know. So what sort of AI are they talking about here, really?
They're talking in generalities, and they do touch on digital assistants. I think that's a big piece of where they were going with that. But because I'm a contrarian, I've chosen to take the opposite tack to what the article was kind of laying out there. And I'm choosing to see that 2019 isn't just a year of saying the same thing and minor iterations. I think that this year we're going to deliver on all the stuff that was promised in 2018 but didn't come to fruition. So that's my optimistic take for the moment.
Give an example of that, because sometimes there are certain things where, you know, people are like, one more year, and it just turns out to be a very difficult problem. Like an example would be, you know, this is the year where we're going to come out with an AI assistant that you could really have a human-like conversation with.
So one that I'll hit on, one of the last things they talk about in this article is autonomous driving. And they make the statement, there's going to be a lot of noise about automotive technology, but nothing distinct or specific. And I'm going to take a strong disagree on that. And perhaps I have some insider perspective on this, because my company has a automotive division that is heavily involved in supporting autonomous driving. So I am very confident that there will be distinct and specific developments in the autonomous driving realm in 2019. However, you are not going to see consumer-ready level 5 ADAS in 2019.
Yeah. So that's, well,
again,
that
level 5 is that, you know, hands off, asleep at the wheel. Maybe there isn't even a steering wheel. That's not coming. But there are a lot of driver assistive autonomous technologies out there that either are or will be rolling out in 2019, and that's concrete advancement there. It's not nothing. It's just, you know, we're not seeing the flying cars of 2019, but we are seeing advancements in smarter cars.
There seems to be this like, I can almost relate it to politics with the media, where there's this cycle of overhype and disappointed. So everything is getting better and better, but they're always prepping you to be disappointed about everything. And it's just, I guess that's not exactly the same as what's going on in politics, but it's the same sort of weird media cycle where they can't stop themselves.
Well, and because, so autonomous driving may be an interesting, a separately interesting case, because I think a lot of the startups in that area are coming to the realization of, this is a lot harder of a problem than we initially thought.
Yeah, how do you do a startup in autonomous driving? That would be, well, I mean, I could see you consult for the big companies, but it seems like you really need a big...
When I say a startup, I don't mean like, you know, a garage startup, but I mean companies that are not traditionally automotive companies that are doing this.
I see. Yeah.
So I would venture to say that your Audis, your General Motors, your Ford, your Chevy, they know what they're doing here, and they are not the ones who are making grand sweeping predictions, claims about how they're not pitching the things that like a Tesla is.
Yeah, I saw a very because they negative know better. Article.
They're doing yeoman's work making advances here, but they're not overselling, because they've been in the automotive world for, 50, 60, close to when did the first Fords roll off the assembly line? We've got to be coming up
like
close 100
years
on 100 years now.
Yeah.
So they know this market better than any of these new kids on the block. They're not going to risk their market positions over making promises that they can't deliver on and that their shareholders are going to hold them accountable for.
I would add a caveat that, sometimes the incumbents don't really get the the new technology that well, but I don't think that's the
case.
Oh,
but they're going to co-opt the shit out of it as soon as somebody else breaks through the barrier.
I
was about to go off on a completely unrelated tangent, so I'm going to pack that away.
No, you can, but I think you're right. I think that they are getting it. Not that, you know, I think Waymo is way ahead, but I just think that, you know, I already saw someone on Twitter saying, like, you know, essentially, you know, we were promised level 5. They don't say level 5, but they said, we were promised level 5. It turns out we'll never get level 5. You know, self-driving cars is not, you know, is not that interesting. It's like, no, actually, it's going to be bring really huge advances even before we get to level 5. And then I think ultimately we'll get there. It's taken a really long time. But you can continue to talk about that. We have a few other things to go, but yes.
Well, yeah. So let's move on to another topic here. So,
all right.
We talked about AI when we opened up this discussion here.
Yeah.
And
digital assistants.
Digital assistants. So, there was a lot of stuff rolled out that had either Amazon digital assistant, I will not name the name, or the Google digital assistant.
It's okay. I have headphones.
it wasn't so much talking about the advances that these products themselves have made, just that they're being integrated into more and more things.
Right.
And they basically gobbled up the market share. So not in this article, because I don't think it had happened yet as of January 3rd. But between then and now, there was a development with one of the lesser players in that field, Microsoft's Cortana digital assistant. And they have actively split Cortana from Windows Search. So before they were one and the same. They're splitting it out now, and their intention is that Cortana is going to be their digital assistant, and they want it to be able to interface with other digital assistant systems, with other, you know, with other capabilities. So they're not trying to directly compete with Google Assistant and the Google Home or Alexa and the Alexa integrated smart home type systems, but perhaps they want to be the front end that you interface with, and then it interfaces with those.
There are a lot of bot makers that want to be that guy that a lot of companies want to build the God bot, essentially is what it's called. And I don't know if that's the way to go. I've been hearing.
Well, I think it's a smart move on their part, even if they
Microsoft,
can't achieve that, because they realize that they
Here's
are not going to
smart.
Win against Google or Amazon for what Google and Amazon are doing.
Sure.
They need to compete in a different way.
The API strategy is always smart. Able to, like Avnish said, work cross-platforms with a lot of different systems and make it really easy for developers to work on top of Cortana. I could tell you firsthand, I tried to work, but this was a couple years ago. They may have improved it, but trying to work on top of Google Assistant was not that easy. Maybe they've improved. They were kind of just starting out.
Think about people who might have both a Google Assistant device and an Amazon Assistant device in their home, switch between the two, you've got to remember the quirks of each system and what the verbal cues are and the interfaces is the command to turn on my dining room lights. Do I call it, is it dining room? Is it dining room lights? Is it D lights?
What have I labeled it as? But I always have to say the word trigger because it's an IFT trigger. And so that makes it annoying. I can't just say, turn on the light.
So if you could have some third party solution sit on top of that you have more control over, and it can translate all that into whatever the proper middle layer controller is there, then that may be a path to a more convenient solution for the end user. I don't know that Cortana is going to win that fight, but it's interesting that they've made that separation.
Yeah, that is an interesting idea. All right. So, and I think that if you could actually be the layer that you could talk to, maybe that works. But I just don't see, then it's like another system that you have to buy on top of the two old systems. Like, it just seems like you're adding complication, not taking it away. That is another risk.
I don't know if we've talked about it on the show before, but the idea that you can kind of substitute in your own digital assistant or you know, substitute in your own choice of algorithm without having to change out all of your hardware and all of your infrastructure would be a coup for the consumer. And so, you know, it kind of opens the floodgates for more competition on developing a better algorithm for that. I don't think this is going to go that route, but it's trying to parallel that in some ways.
All right. So moving on, we have two more things to discuss. There's security and there's virtual reality, which I kind of have some issues with, but let's start with security.
Yeah. So on the security side, there are kind of two things going on here. One is that you're seeing some security as a subscription service products coming out. The idea is that in this more connected world, so we said before that there are all these new devices that have Amazon or Google interface now in your house. So whether that's your microwave or your refrigerator or your washing machine or your speaker system or whatever, your lights, your garage door, your doorbell, your thermostat, they're all tied together. And so that's more things that can be hacked. There are a couple of different companies providing a solution at the network level where they will essentially secure your routers, secure your whole network, and protect you at that level. Two things there. One is that I take issue with this whole put a Band-Aid on it at the router approach, which in theory, yeah, that'll work, but why aren't we designing the endpoint devices to have built-in security, you know, basic built-in security as part of them? And the blunt answer there is that A, nobody thought about it, and B, well, that's hard and expensive, so nobody thought about it. But it's a major failing on the part of these developers, both in the hardware and software side, that there's not really any thought being given to security at the device level. And so we have to basically put a security fence around it at the home router level. The other piece is that it's moving to a security as a subscription service model, which is interesting. You're seeing that in a lot of other places, software as a service, for various use cases. I don't like it because it's just a way for them to extract more money from me.
Right, and then you forget about it, and then you're kind of wondering, do I really need what they're selling?
Yeah. Because if they're actually doing a good job, to maintain that security, it requires constant, you know, updates of the system, improvements. Because sure. it's an adversarial situation.
It's not an arms race against hackers.
Yeah, it's not like a Microsoft Word subscription where I pay a certain amount a month to be able to use Word, and you know they'll roll out some additional features occasionally, but it's not like if I just purchase the one-time desktop version, it's going to stop working in 6 months. It'll work pretty much indefinitely. It just, I won't get new features. So I think there's a good motivation for going this route, but I still don't like moving to a subscription model when I don't like the cash grab aspect of it. It makes me uncomfortable.
Gotcha.
I'm a cheap bastard.
I don't like anything that, like, every time I go into my account, it's like someone's extracting money from me every month. I don't even remember what this is. And it's just like half the stuff is things I don't even need anymore. It's just someone's piggy bank out there. I don't like that feeling. Okay, virtual reality. Last one. Matt, virtual reality has been, I think some people were trying to make it happen in the 80s.
It's forever.
And now, Facebook, by buying Oculus, really wanted to make virtual reality huge. This is something that I think hasn't panned out as quickly as people had hoped. The technology's there. It's not really about, you know, it's not really about building a better, you know, computer or anything like that. It's not about, you know, we have pretty good software.
Well, it is and it isn't. The full quote from this article is
it's the network.
The industry has been plagued by high cost hardware, motion sickness, a dearth of compelling content, and a general lack of consumer interest.
That last one is what's killing it.
Yeah. Well, so they've got a bit of a chicken or an egg issue here. I think they've overcome most of the technical challenges, with the exception of high cost hardware. And it's gotten a lot better. It's certainly within reach. But if they can make it even cheaper, then there's the potential for market penetration. But the chicken or the egg aspect here is that there's no content. And the reason there's no content is that nobody's making that content, and no one's making that content because nobody, there's not an install base of people to sell it to who already own the hardware, and nobody's buying the hardware because there's no content. You know, there's not a must-have, you know, VR exclusive experience that's justifying them to go out and buy it.
Well, but think about it. I mean, so theoretically, video game consoles would have the same problem, and yet, it's become a tough business recently. But they overcome that problem by having their kind of in-house games,
right?
Why is it that a VR company can't have their in-house applications? Is it just because they can't find applications that like have this mass appeal that everyone's like, oh, I have to go out and buy a VR headset because I want this application, I want this killer app. Maybe that doesn't exist right now.
Yeah, it's not there yet. There's some cool experiences, but it falls to the level of gimmick.
Yeah, I'd be happy to go to a mall and see a demo, and I did that once.
The analogy I would make is 3D in movies. That the killer app for that was Avatar. I was going to say Fern Gully of the
right.
Smurfs, but it was kind of a one off. It was a flash in the pan. Everyone went to see it except for me, and thought it was amazing. And then
I saw it, unfortunately.
Nobody,
no, I didn't think it was amazing. I liked it, but it wasn't.
Nobody did anything else with it after that, other than, you know, some movies did a gimmicky thing where they throw in one scene that takes advantage of 3D, and you can tell when you watch it afterwards that, oh, this is the part where they did something funky with 3D. But because I'm watching it on DVD at home and I don't have a 3D television, that it just looks forced.
Well, no, I mean, look, I've gone to the movies quite a bit and see, like, the Harry Potter movies and things like that have pretty extensive 3D, and they're pretty cool to see in the theater. But I stopped going so much because then, like, each ticket ends up being like $30.
Well, yeah.
And then I have the TV that I got has 3D glasses. I have 3D glasses. They're right next to the TV, and I just never used them. I never bothered. It's just, let's just watch the movie flat. I don't care. I don't know. I don't know what's going to make me reach over and grab those glasses, but it doesn't.
It's
weird, right?
I should wearing Google glasses.
Yeah, I should. But VR is even worse. You actually have to put something over your head. You can't see what's going on around you, and it's like that's something.
That's
that
one of the
do.
Complaints I've heard about it, and I don't have any firsthand experience, but it's isolating. That even if you're in a VR world with other people, to enter that VR world, you basically have to cut yourself off from everyone around you. So you can't, like, hang out with friends and, you know, like you can watch, assuming you have the right equipment, you can watch a 3D movie with friends from your couch.
Sure.
You can play a video game or you can watch, you know, each other playing a video game and pass the controller around, even if it's not a, you know, local multiplayer on the couch game. It's much more difficult to do that experience with VR because you've got the one person who's in it, and I suppose you could have other people watching that, but they're seeing, you know, either another view or the view from that person, but they're not in the rig, and so they're not having the experience. So
yeah, but you don't, and you don't want to pass that thing around to get everyone's hair stuff on you,
right? And I feel like it would be a weird, perhaps the logical extreme of what people are saying about our culture, how we've all got our heads deep in our cell phones, that even when you get a group of people together in the same room to hang out, everybody's looking at their own phone and not talking to each other. So now imagine that, except instead of everybody looking at their phone, everyone's got on VR goggles.
Yeah, it's
and
like,
a headset,
why even bother?
And they're all sitting in the same room, but they're even if they're interacting with each, yeah, it's.
I don't see it. I don't see it. But I will say that some of this technology is getting, you know, frighteningly realistic. It's just there hasn't been a use case for it yet. So yeah, well, I think we've gone
and
over.
They're doing some really cool stuff with haptics, which I think is amazing. I don't know that there's a good use case for it outside of again, you know, gimmicky or you know, kind of tailored experience stuff. But I want it to.
Well, there was that Shark Tank. Cool. There was that Shark Tank where it was like a VR headset. Someone was pitching a VR headset on top of this. I think it was like a omnidirectional treadmill type thing.
Yeah, there are a couple of companies doing stuff like
and
that.
It's, and they invest. They were like, this is awesome. I want one. But how are you going to get tons of people? First of all, you need like a big space in your home. I was watching a funny Twitter feed last night about how like, oh, I always put my Peloton bike in my $15 million penthouse, you know, because that's where all the commercials have the picture, yep. Like you're like in the greenhouse. Yeah, well,
the one place you are seeing VR,
but it's like where would you put that
for consumers?
And where would you, something in, that expensive, I don't know in, if people are going to buy it. You're not going to buy it for your kids.
So you're seeing it at basically VR laser tag, basically where you've got a, you know, facility. It's in a strip mall or a big warehouse somewhere where everybody puts on their VR helmets, and it's almost more of like an augmented reality type thing. It's like, okay, so now we can you know, drop in zombies or whatever the villain du jour is, and you can shoot them up with your team of friends. And they, because they can justify the expense of all the equipment to do that, and you can justify going to play it for, you know, an hour with some friends, but you're not going to drop the money for a full rig like that and put it in your home and, you know, set up the, you know, whether it's the cameras or the sensors. Most people aren't into it enough for that to make sense for them.
Yeah.
But one-time experience, a one-off, that makes sense. But if it's relegated to that world, then we're not going to see the kind of innovation that I think everybody was hoping for.
Yeah, I'd agree. If you have ideas for applications on these technologies or predictions on where some of this stuff is going to go, please email the show, localmaxradio@gmail.com. Aaron, thanks for coming on today. I think we just recorded two shows.
Yeah. We said we were going to do 20 minutes, and here we are 90 minutes later.
That's okay. We record two shows, and that way, you know, that way it's all done. Two very excellent shows, I might add. So, okay. Anything else before we go?
I'm sure there is, but I can't think of it.
All right, that's a no. So, all right, we'll put this out, and thanks for going through these articles with me. I'm fascinated by this stuff. This is a little bit outside my area of expertise, but it's very important to me when it comes to, you know, trying to forecast what products are good to work on. And if you're an engineer, you're working on machine learning or just software engineering or client side, server side, you really want to have a pulse on where different types of technology is going, and consumer technology is one of those. And so I think it's worth bringing up from time to time. So thanks again, and have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account, @MaxSklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.
And she said, I don't care what you say, you're going to see.